From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Asia and the Far East, two parts of the world still little known to most Americans. Toward an understanding of two very different but important aspects of societies and cultures in Asia and the Far East, Soundings now presents conversations with two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Donald Horowitz of Duke University and Zhaojing Lun, a freelance journalist from the People's Republic of China. First on this edition of Soundings, a discussion with Donald Horowitz about ethnic conflict in the Far East. Following that conversation, a discussion with Zhaojing Lun about social and political reform in contemporary China. Donald Horowitz is a professor of law, public policy studies, and political science at Duke University. Donald Horowitz is the author of Ethnic Groups in Conflict, soon to be published by the University of California Press. Don, let's begin our conversation about the book that you have written and work that you are doing at the Humanities Center. Now, you've written a book called Ethnic Groups in Conflict, and at the Humanities Center, you're working on a book which you are calling tentatively The Deadly Ethnic Riot. You've written, for instance, that that ethnic violence accounts for, what do you say, about 10 million lives lost in the last, 20, 30, 40 years?
In the post-war period. That is actually not my count, but someone else's count. And it seems a reasonable count, depending on how one characterizes ethnic violence and how inclusively one characterizes it. Certainly, if you take into account international warfare that is the result of ethnic antipathy, for example, Somalia, Ethiopia, India, Pakistan, the figure is probably conservative.
10 million would be conservative.
Yes.
Well, how does that sort of conflict reflect what you call ethnicity? Can you give me a general definition, an abstract kind of thing?
Yes, I would argue that ethnicity is a should be defined broadly to encompass groups that are defined by reference to some notion of common origin, real or fictitious, so that an ethnic group might be differentiated from another ethnic group in the same environment by virtue of speaking a different language, or adhering to a different religion, or having a different color and appearance, or even a different regional origin. The question is not what the particular indicator of differentiation is, but rather whether there's a notion of peoplehood involved. And where there's a notion of peoplehood and common origin, I would call those groups ethnic groups. For example, a very common phenomenon around the world, and particularly in Asia and Africa, is the existence of ethnically based political parties. Now, we don't have those in the United States, and so we find them a little bit unusual. But in country after country where there are free elections, groups tend to support parties associated with the cause of their ethnic group. And where you've got two groups, let us say A and B, where A is 60% of the population and B is 40% of the population, and you have an election, assuming the groups are randomly distributed and assuming you've got a parliamentary system, typically what happens is group A will then end up with something like 60% of the seats, and group B will be excluded from power not just in that election, but in perpetuity as it sees it. And as you can imagine, this is a highly explosive situation.
Now, we've had our problems in America. There are what are called the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and you've looked at ethnic conflict in many societies. Would you say that Americans generally are aware of ethnic violence and its connection to politics?
No, I would say that Americans are heavily immured in their own society and in its history when it comes to thinking about ethnic matters. And two things stand out particularly about the American view of these matters. One is the American propensity to think of ethnic relations in terms of subordination. Because of our experience of slavery and Jim Crow, we ask about ethnic relations, who's on top? We have a hierarchical view of ethnic relations. And that is, in fact, one type of ethnic system around the world. But it's not the most frequent type. As a matter of fact, most groups are not ranked hierarchically in their relations to other groups, but are rather what I like to call unranked, that mm-hmm. is, they're cross-class groups, so that instead of the relations between superordinates and subordinates, ethnic relations are characterized by relations between groups that are more or less equal in the fixed status hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And those interactions are every bit as interesting and important and every bit as conflict prone as relations between superordinates and subordinates.
Give me a specific example. I understand that that you have written you're investigating the Sri Lanka riots in the summer of 1983. Tell me about them. What happened? How have you is it possible to nail down causal elements as well as descriptions of the circumstances themselves?
Well, I think it is. Yes, in Sri Lanka there has been a very tragic situation where two main ethnic groups, the Sinhalese and the Tamils, have been locked in a conflict.
Now, these are tribes. How would you describe these elements or factions, or what do you call them?
Well, I call them ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. They're differentiated in the first instance by language, in mm-hmm. the second instance by religion, and only in small measure by differences in color and appearance.
What's the source of the enmity? Where does it come from?
Well, a variety of sources, and actually the Sri Lanka enmity is quite typical of some others. It's a mix of ancient enmity and modern enmity, perhaps has a stronger element of ancient enmity than the typical ethnic riot does. When the Sinhalese came to Sri Lanka as Buddhists, they tended to regard Sri Lanka as a special place for Buddhism. And the Tamils, when they arrived somewhat later, came as invaders. And so the Sinhalese kings and the Tamil kings warred over the island, and they went back and forth over various parts of the island. And there are Sinhalese legends about great fights between individual Sinhalese kings, hand-to-hand combat between Sinhalese kings and Tamil kings. So that there is in Sinhalese popular history, more than in scholarly history, some notion that the Tamils are enemies. Incidentally, I should say immediately that there's a large element of myth in this, mm-hmm. because in fact there's been a considerable degree of cooperative interchange between Tamils and Sinhalese over the centuries.
Well, then who's been propagating it? Am I being cynical?
No, not entirely, but I don't think that the narrow gains from ethnic conflict are the whole story. That is, there are particular classes of people, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, people in competition for jobs and the like, who do have something tangible at stake. But on the other hand, there are many people, village people in particular, who don't have very much at stake and who nevertheless pursue the enmity. And that's one of the crucial questions in ethnic conflict theory. Why is it that people who don't seem to have a tangible stake in the outcome seem to be so invested in the conflict? And I think the only way you can answer that question is to look at the comparisons that have been made between ethnic groups. And in the case of Sri Lanka, for a considerable period of time, the British and the Sinhalese themselves regarded the Tamils as more diligent and industrious and more prone to achievement than they themselves were. And naturally, if you feel that way about another people, and authoritative sources tell you mm-hmm. that that's the way the comparison comes out,
it's likely to affect your behavior.
Indeed, it's likely to be very irritating. And as a matter of fact, around the world, there are lots of comparisons of this very sort that were made between groups that were regarded on the one hand as being rather backward and lazy and indolent and unmotivated and ill-disposed to achievement-oriented behavior, mm-hmm. And groups, on the other hand, that were regarded as diligent, industrious, hardworking, prone to achievement. What's happened, essentially, is that the Sinhalese, in excluding the Tamils from full participation in the political system of the island, have unwittingly fostered the development of a separatist movement among the Tamils. The Tamils would ordinarily be very reluctant secessionists because, after all, they'd be left with a mini-state without any significant resources in the most arid and unproductive parts of the island. They would no doubt much prefer to continue to have opportunities in government employment available to them in Colombo, the capital, so that they can send remittances back home. Nevertheless, A separatist movement has grown up among the Tamils, which looks increasingly serious. It has a terrorist wing. And in the summer of 1983, there was a terrorist attack on an army patrol, which killed something like 14 soldiers, Sinhalese soldiers. And that's what precipitated the outburst of rioting against the Tamils.
Now tell me about the riot itself.
Well, the riot was like many others.
Where did it occur?
It occurred in the first instance in Colombo, mm-hmm. where there are many Tamils. It brought out the usual participants in riots, namely Sinhalese youth. Typically, riot participants who engage in deadly ethnic riots are in their early 20s, mid-20s. There were many Tamils killed in and around Colombo. We don't have an exact casualty figure. And I should say, incidentally, typically modern weapons, that is, guns, are not used in ethnic riots in Asia and Africa. So that when 30, 40, 50 people are killed, we're talking about people being killed in hand-to-hand combat. What that generally means is an injury toll many times that number, and a refugee toll that is at least 100 to 1. That is, for every death that you get in a riot like this, you're likely to get at least 100 refugees.
How long did all of this go on, this riot in Sri Lanka in the summer of 83?
It went on for several days. The average ethnic riot goes on for something like 3, 4, 5 days, depending in large measure on how effective the security forces are and how determined the security forces are to control it.
Don, let's step back from your specific descriptions and your analysis of the Sri Lanka riots in the summer of 1983. Tell me what sorts of general upshots your investigations into ethnic conflict and ethnic violence might have for makers of public policy. You say, for instance, at one point in your book that you are trying to look for categories, for general principles, ways to bring all of these various threads together.
Yes, well, the book Ethnic Groups in Conflict has got quite a lot of material on policies to reduce ethnic tensions. They tend to fall into three categories. Territorial techniques, like federalism and regional autonomy, mm-hmm. for example. Electoral devices that have the effect of reducing the zero-sum quality of ethnic competition in politics. And preferential policies, which are designed to prefer underrepresented groups in education or employment or in business or in land ownership or what have you. Now, having said all that, I think there is something about human nature that is revealed by ethnic group conflict.
And what's that?
And it's not all bad.
Okay.
That is, if you look at ethnic violence, if you're a student of the sort of brutality that's involved in the deadly ethnic riot, for example, you may come away discouraged, and you may say that everybody is deep down just a killer inside. On the other hand, you may come away with a rather different notion that institutions and contexts shape human behavior for better and for worse, so that the riot occurs when the institutions permit it to occur, but by the same token, the institutions can operate to inhibit.
So you're taking us in the direction of saying that you may not be able to change human nature, but you can change human institutions as a means of precluding ethnic violence.
Yes, and I think we've underestimated the extent to which people's behavior is governed by the relations in which they find themselves and the context in which they have to function.
Donald Horowitz is a professor at Duke University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book entitled Ethnic Groups in Conflict, soon to be published by the University of California Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Culture and Politics in Asia and the Far East concludes now with a conversation with another scholar at the National Humanities Center. Zhaojing Lund is a freelance journalist from the People's Republic of China. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Zhaojing Lund worked on a book about the relevance of the American political system to China's political modernization. Zhaojing Lund, you are a Chinese journalist. You are spending a year at the National Humanities Center writing a book about the American political system that you will publish for Chinese audiences. Let's step away from your current project for a moment. Tell me about the economic reforms, that economic and political, I guess, that are underway in the People's Republic of China.
Well, things are really moving fast and at dizzying speed that many people are surprised. They are reforming the planning system. Mm-hmm. They are granting greater autonomy to the state enterprises. And there has also been some relaxation of political control.
Zhao Jinglan, tell me about some of these reforms that are going on. Be specific for me. What do they hold out for the future of the average citizen in the People's Republic of China? Is there going to be more economic freedom?
Oh, yes. In the past, agriculture was highly collectivized. There were people's communes, very large organizations embracing several villages with a total of perhaps 20,000 households, very large organizations. But that didn't work. Chinese agriculture stagnated. So they decentralized decision-making, and finally, actually, the people's communes are now defunct. Mm-hmm. And production is now really carried out by individual peasant households themselves by signing an agreement or a contract with the production brigade to which these households belong. And they get an assignment of a plot of land, and they are contracted to produce a certain amount from that piece of land, mm-hmm. and turn that over to the collective.
Do words like the profit motive enter into the discussions between the Chinese leadership and the people who are doing the producing? Do they think of it that way?
Not so much the term a profit motive in the countryside. Mm-hmm. It's material incentive they're talking about.
I understand that there is a tension, Zhao Jinglan, between the people who live in the cities and the people who live in the rural areas of the People's Republic. Is this true?
For many years, there has been tension, I would say.
Would you call it jealousy? How would you characterize it?
The Chinese, economically, the Chinese would say there were the scissors effect.
Scissors,
meaning industrial goods were overpriced and agricultural products underpriced. Uh-huh. In fact, the Chinese were financing their industrialization at the expense of the peasants. Mm-hmm. But now, as a result of the agricultural reform, the peasants are much better off than before. Not only they can keep the amount that is over and above the contracted amount, mm-hmm. they now have larger private plots. They can dispose their products from the private plots at free market at higher prices. And the government has also increased the procurement prices mm-hmm. for farm products. So all these increase farm income. And on top of that, these peasants are also going into sidelines production, village industries, crafts, so that they get much more cash income. Mm-hmm. And in the past, you could describe the situation as an influx of villagers into the cities trying to look for higher standards of living.
Now, is that going to reverse itself?
Now, actually, there has been some reversal, and uh-huh. some people even resigning from government jobs to go back to the countryside.
To go back.
Yes.
Do the Chinese people think of this as capitalism? How do they conceive of it? How would you characterize the discourse among in the People's Republic of China about what you've been describing, material advantage, the beginnings of consumerism? Do they think of it in Western terms?
No, I don't think so. The people have been educated in Marxism for mm-hmm. so many years. But as a result of the Cultural Revolution and a series of political campaigns that they lived through, I think they are losing interest in Marxism as a theory. The party now claims that Marx lived more than 100 years ago, mm-hmm. and he never experienced the complexities of the modern world.
Uh-huh.
So the people should no longer follow too rigidly
uh-huh.
the specific tenets of Marxism and specific conclusions of Marxism, but they are not abandoning Marxism as a doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
They still uphold Marx's stand, method of analysis,
mm-hmm.
and they still call themselves Marxists.
Xiao Jinglan, how will the economic reforms that we're discussing in China, in very broad terms, admittedly, how will they affect the culture of China? China has an immense history and tradition. Will there be an impact there?
Well, I think there will. But it'll take time. The Chinese now talk very much about interdependence.
With other countries.
With other countries uh-huh. and technological revolution, especially information explosion.
Uh-huh. Computers, things like that.
And they are learning more and more about the outside world and no longer xenophobic as the China used to be.
Mm-hmm. Xiao Jinglan, generalize for me about Chinese culture. If you could single out one or two issues or elements in Chinese culture that you think have been badly affected by Western influences, what would they be? And by contrast, are there elements in Chinese culture that have been strengthened by contact with the West? Could you reflect on that for me?
Well, I'll talk about what are the elements in Chinese culture that has been holding China back.
Mm-hmm.
That is the Confucianist idea of hierarchy,
uh-huh.
of patriarchy.
Notions about authority.
Notions of authority uh-huh. and emperor worship.
Now, this doesn't enter solely into the political structure so much as into the notions about the family and just everyday life. Do I have that right?
Yes. Confucianism
yeah.
Preaches very rigid relationship between not only between the ruler and the subject,
uh-huh.
but also between father and son, husband and wife,
mm-hmm.
and requires absolute obedience.
Mm-hmm.
The son is to be filial, not just filial, but obedient to, mm-hmm. to the father and the wife to the husband.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an element. It's a straitjacket.
Do you think that's going to change?
One reason why we had a Cultural Revolution was Mao launched it. He had such authority.
Mm-hmm.
to be able to launch such a mass movement
mm-hmm.
that involved hundreds of millions. Because there was patriarchy and emperor worship. He was a new emperor.
Right. Well, again, Xiao Jinglan, is that going to change with more contact with the West?
They are already changing.
Uh-huh.
The Chinese have learned a lesson from the Cultural Revolution of the arbitrariness of power.
Uh-huh.
And that could be disastrous.
Yeah.
So... And that's in Chinese tradition, because the Chinese never had a rule of law.
Uh-huh.
The Chinese have always had rule by men. But there is still a habit that dies hard, that is authority worship,
mm-hmm.
patriarchy. And that's why the present leadership is trying to decentralize power, decision-making. And some of their advisors... brain trust.
Hmm.
There's even talking about separation of powers and checks and balance.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, when you have a one-party state, how that would work remains to be seen.
These are new notions, or not new notions, but they're altogether different notions for the Chinese citizenry, aren't they?
Of course, very, very different. For instance, an ordinary Chinese, even today, would not understand why the American president cannot issue orders to Congress.
Right.
Because in a highly centralized system, mm-hmm. you have the party leadership and the head of the party can issue orders to anybody.
Right.
I think even though the two peoples have very different historical and cultural background, And I'm strongly against what some American scholars call ethical imperialism or imperialist messianism.
Mm-hmm.
Many Americans believe that their system is the best, and they like to have it spread all over the world, not just by example, but by active intervention. That's why it is imperialist messianism. I'm against that. Because of the historical and cultural differences, I don't think you can lift the American system in its entirety and impose it on time. This doesn't mean the American experience is irrelevant.
Uh-huh.
It is, because human societies face more or less the same questions: justice, democracy, equality. And the Chinese have learned their lesson from the Cultural Revolution, which they themselves call a disaster, excessive concentration of power.
Yeah.
But the American system is designed for a weak executive, protection of the individual, and the rule of law, and constitutionalism, that is, people accept the result of a due process. When it's judged according to law, they accept the outcome of, mm-hmm. of the process.
Zhao Jinglun, a final quick question. Tell me the thing that you enjoy most about life in the United States, and tell me the thing that irritates you the most.
To be very frank, I've lived here for 4 years. Actually, I should have returned to China sooner, much earlier. I'm staying here because I can write whatever I want to.
That would be the high point.
That would be the, for me as a working journalist, a freelance writer, would be the most important advantage.
Uh-huh. And the downside?
Here. And the downside, again, to be very frank, is somewhat veiled racism, not just against the blacks and Hispanics, but also against other colored people like the Chinese and Asians. People may treat me very politely, courteously, but having lived here so long, I can sense there is a condescension. The white male is the supremacy of the white male. I can sense that.
Zhao Jinglun is a freelance journalist from the People's Republic of China. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Zhao Jinglun worked on a forthcoming book about the relevance of the American political system to China's political modernization. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Cultures and Politics in Asia and the Far East, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about contemporary philosophy and public policy. The Soundings panelists will be scholars from the University of Florida, Rice University, and North Carolina State University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for discussions with two scholars about very different but very important aspects of culture and politics in Asia and the Far East. Donald Horowitz of Duke University will discuss his new book, Ethnic Groups in Conflict. And Zhao Jinglun, a freelance journalist from the People's Republic of China, will discuss social and political reform in China today. Politics and Culture in Asia and the Far East, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.